Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer J. Robert Lennon. Lennon is the author of many novels, including The Light of Falling Stars, Mailman, and Pieces for the Left Hand. His stories have appeared in Paris Review, Harper's, and The New Yorker. He recently published his seventh well-received novel, Castle, published by Grey Wolf Press. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you.
Now, as a child, I've heard that you loved science fiction and horror stories. Mm-hmm. Is this what moved you to write?
Yeah, I think so. The first time I actually remember actively wanting, desiring to be a writer. And I don't mean wanting to write. I mean wanting to be a writer, wanting to have written, was when I read the Stephen King short story collections from the 70s and 80s, where he would put like a long explanation of each short story in the back of the book. Uh-huh. And now as a writer, I'm sort of loath to explain myself. I sort of like I like the mystery of a story now. I don't want it explained to me. But at the time, the idea of creating something and then getting to explain it to people was really appealing, and it made me want to have that job. But it didn't really occur to me that it was something I could actually do until much later.
Uh-huh. And do you remember some of the first subject matter that you were preoccupied with when you began writing, writing?
The first thing I remember writing was a poem about a dead guy. It was like a description of his tombstone.
Really?
So I guess I had a dark imagination even then. But everything was a joke, you know, until I was about 24. I did everything for laughs. And it wasn't until a teacher told me, her comment on a short story that I was really proud of was, "Well, if this is the kind of thing you want to write, this is about as good as it's going to get." I was like, ouch!
Wow.
Yeah.
That's discouraging. And how did that make you feel?
It was quite the opposite. I think she knew that it would make me want to be more ambitious. And it worked. That was actually the novelist Ann Patchett who was teaching the graduate school where I got my writer's education.
Uh-huh. So she actually gave you a challenge and you stood up to it.
Yeah, well, she was a hard ass, and that was exactly what I needed, you know. I think I was one of those kids who I grew up in kind of a small town, and, you know, I like to do sort of weird things, and I did pretty well in school. So it was sort of easy to get adult approval for what I did. I didn't have to work very hard for people to just say good job and leave me alone. But it wasn't until I started meeting people smarter than me that it began to occur to me that maybe I couldn't rely on my wise guy persona and lazy work ethic anymore.
Well, I'm glad you learned that. A lot of people haven't learned that one. Now, your first novel was called Light of Falling Stars. Gorgeous title, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
It's about the aftermath of a plane crash. Now, was this based on anything that had touched your life?
Not really, but I've always had I guess a lot of people probably have a morbid fascination with plane crashes.
I do, too.
You know, it's the perfect thing to be afraid of, because it's an ordinary thing that everyone does, transformed into, you know, terror and disaster.
Uh-huh.
Whenever a plane crash would happen, I would sort of read the newspaper reports in detail to see how it happened, you know. The other thing was that up until that point in my life, I'd only written short stories. I tried to write a novel, but it was really terrible. And I thought, well, I know how to write a short story, and I could probably write a really long story. So why don't I do a novel in which a cataclysmic event sets certain people's lives on different paths? And I can essentially write five stories, or might have been four, I can't remember, and have them intersect here and there, and to make it sort of an ensemble novel, and then try to tie it together somehow at the end. And it was a sort of way into the novel form for me.
Well, I'm glad you found it. Now, your work is often humorous and dark, and you even described your writing as a little bit over the top. Is this part of your personality, or do you think this is the times we're living in?
Maybe it's a combination of the two. I mean, I come from a family of loud talkers, people who have a really good time together and are always laughing hysterically at each other.
At each other?
Yeah, well, mostly in mostly at each other's jokes rather than mocking, not in a mocking way.
Uh-huh.
So I sort of already have a taste for over-the-top stories. You know, in my family, if you have some random minor misfortune, within about an hour, one of my family members will have spun it into some kind of comic epic, you know. Like yesterday, I needed some clapboard from the side of my house, but part of the house was rotting, and I went, unfortunately, the place I was closest to at the time was Lowe's. And I went into Lowe's, and I had this exchange with this guy who didn't know what clapboard was. I had a piece of it in my hand, and he'd never heard of this siding that's on almost every
unbelievable
every house in upstate New York. So by the time I was in my car leaving Lowe's, I already knew how I was going to relate the story to my family at our Jersey Shore reunion this summer. But anyway, I think that's sort of where the over-the-top part of my writing comes from. It's just I've sort of acculturated to be that way by my family.
Do you think it's a defense mechanism, or is it a way to communicate things that could be disturbing?
I prefer to use it as the latter, and I think it's a way into dark subjects to make them, I wouldn't say palatable to other people, but to make them tolerable, to make them interesting without being gratuitously creepy or off-putting.
Sounds very Irish to me. I have Irish grandparents.
There's some of that in the Lennon clan.
Now, in your novel Mailman, the protagonist is slowly descending into madness. Mm. Is this based on anything? I mean, we have heard stories through the years of mail people going crazy in different mail offices and killing each other.
I certainly wasn't. You know, this my mailman is not murderous in the least. His madness is directed inward. So I wasn't playing off of the going postal cliche. But he was actually inspired by a specific guy I knew in Montana where I was in graduate school who was my mailman. And he was also a customer of mine at the coffee shop where I was a barista.
Oh.
And he was very intense. And he would come and order quadruple espressos and park his mail truck on the yellow line. And, you know, he went, like the guy in my book, he went to Kazakhstan for the Peace Corps and came back 2 weeks later. And so I wrote a short story of a guy I invented based on the four or five things I knew about this guy. Mm-hmm. And when I finished it, my wife said, "You should keep going. You should make a novel for this guy." And as I was writing it, I thought, "No, this is never going to be published because it was just so." I was having too much fun writing it for it to be any good.
But it turned out to be critically acclaimed.
I guess so. It didn't sell very well, but I'm really proud of it. I think I still think of it as my best book, although I don't make any claims for being able to know what of mine is any good and what isn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you were writing that, did you look into the subject of mental illness?
A little bit. I looked more into physics and being a postal carrier.
Really? I would never connect the two.
Well, the character is a sort of failed physicist. He's very smart, but his personality has rendered him essentially incapable of achieving any success in his field. Mm. And he ends up dropping out of school and becoming a postal carrier. And, of course, he has to deliver the mail to his nemesis, the scientist he knew whom he thinks he's smarter than. But as far as the mental illness goes, it wasn't. I wouldn't say that the guy is diagnosable. I hadn't thought of it in a clinical sense, but more of a metaphorical sense. The sense in which there is a limit to the way we can manipulate our own lives, our own personalities, our own imaginations. And he sort of bumps up against those limits. I decided I would throw obstacles in this guy's path and test him and see what would make him break.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of what the experiment of the book was, I suppose.
Hmm. Now, we have to talk about your new novel, Castle, and I just finished reading it. It's great. It's been described as neo-gothic, spooky. Tell us about it. Where did it come from?
Well, I had, for about a year, I was taking notes for what was going to be a novel about an Iraq War veteran who is in sort of a fugue state and he was going to wander out of a VA hospital and fall in with a terrorist group. I had this elaborate plot idea. And, of course, if you've read Castle, this doesn't describe it in any way. But I wasn't getting anywhere with it. The whole thing seemed too much of a contrivance. And then I was talking with my wife, who's also a writer, and she was casting around for ideas for a novel she might write. And one of them was an article she had read in a magazine called Weird New Jersey that I highly recommend, about a guy who'd been wandering around in a national forest or a state forest and had come across the ruins, what appeared to be the ruins of a castle. And this magazine's full of little inexplicable, creepy stories, anecdotes that readers send in about things that happened to them in New Jersey. And doesn't it sound great?
It does.
It's every bit as good as it sounds.
Everybody makes fun of New Jersey, but that's for another show.
Well, yeah, that's, you know, as I've said before, it's God's gift to comedy. And I'm proud to have grown up there. But anyway, so this was on my wife's list of possibilities, and as soon as I heard it, I knew I was going to have to steal it from her. So she kindly gave me permission to take it, and I just started writing about a guy. I turned into a guy who was buying some land and would discover a castle on it. And it wasn't until I was a week into writing the thing that I was talking to my wife once again about the book and where it might go. And I said, I wish I'd been able to write that Iraq War veteran book. And she said, oh, well, this, you know, this is it. It's that's your guy. I suddenly realized how it could all work. And I'm not sure that it does in the end. I think it does. I consider it to be a little bit of an oddball book in my oeuvre.
I think it works. It's a very surprising the way it ends, I think.
Yeah, and I won't reveal too much for anyone who might want to read it. But I was concerned it would seem sort of tacked on, but the ending would seem kind of tacked on. But in fact, that was the whole conception of the novel came from originally, the way it ended up.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. And did you do a lot of research about Iraq veterans coming back into the country?
And I did a lot of, the subject of torture comes up in the book, I'll say that much, and I did a lot of research on that, and the way things fall apart, or fell apart, in the prisons in Iraq in which this was taking place, mm-hmm. and at Guantanamo as well. Mm-hmm. It was essentially right up the chain of command. There were insinuations and bits of irresponsibility. People not qualified to do things were being put in charge of them, and things spiraling out of control as a result. And there's all kinds of confusion about how much of it was intentional and how much was, we want these things to happen, so we'll make sure that we put incompetent people in there to let them happen, or how much of it was dictated from above. But at any rate, I came up with a plausible scenario for the past tense of the book to unfold in, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. I hope it's accurate.
Yeah, indeed. But were you worried about real people from Iraq judging this book?
Sure, I still am. I mean, uh-huh. My narrator is not a likable person.
First he seems to be, because he seems familiar.
Yeah, and he's very straightforward and articulate. I wanted the voice to be sort of welcoming, but weirdly off-putting in a way you can't quite put your finger on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
At least that was my aim.
Yeah.
But I like to think that readers who are veterans or know veterans would read this as the story of a particular person sort of caught in the wheels of history rather than some kind of blanket condemnation of people like him who served in the same kind of capacity he did. But I think it's fairly clear that that's not what I mean.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I hope so anyway.
Now, did J. Robert Lennon want to write this book about Iraq because he himself is disturbed by what's happening?
Sure.
Or he wanted to use it as a novelistic way of expressing politics?
It's a little of both. I mean, you know, like a lot of people, I've been preoccupied with politics over the last 8 years. And previously, I had not been very engaged politically.
Mm.
I was always more of an observer and not someone who wanted to involve himself in actively thinking about these issues. But I was really disturbed about how the Iraq War came about and how it was being conducted. And, you know, I'm a Democrat, so I was already distrustful of the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. But after Abu Ghraib, I began to get really angry. And there's not much you can do, really, with anger at your government. No, unless you want to start a militia or something and stop paying taxes, which was not in my nature to do. So I wanted to write a politically engaged novel that nevertheless did not seem like a polemic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And through multiple revisions, I brought it closer and closer to what I thought, the way I thought it could work. But again, I hope it does. I think whenever you throw politics into art, people begin to judge it more harshly, perhaps. And I knew that going in.
If you're just joining us, my guest is J. Robert Lennon. He's a novelist, and we're discussing his most recent novel called Castle. Now, it's amazing to me how you can turn these beautiful upstate towns into these menacing, dark landscapes. Where did that come from? Is there something happening in your yard?
No, my yard is quite idyllic, actually. It's got chickens walking around and a garden. It's very pleasant to be there. No, and I love this area. I've lived here for, God, a dozen years this fall.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, my wife and I moved here from Montana, which has a lot of very imposing, untrammeled wilderness. It feels very, very much resists human habitation, you know.
So it must be kind of eerie.
It is, but there was something about upstate New York when we moved here that I thought was almost more eerie. It's a trammeled wilderness. You know, there's lots of woods. There are lots of unpeopled places in upstate New York, but people have been there before. I think the ghosts of previous generations are everywhere here. And people, especially in small towns, tend to stay in one place their whole lives. And so there's this long history of, you know, people whose grandparents and great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents are from this area.
Yeah, it astounds me.
Yeah, and I think that sort of web of connections, I mean, we sort of, we presume to have free will, especially in an enlightened place like Ithaca, but I never forget about the history of the place and what things used to be like, and you know, that I sort of fold all that into the work I'm doing. You know, a piece of land in the novel has had there's an Indian massacre that took place.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up. Maybe some of the ghosts that you're feeling are the Native Americans in the history of the way they were treated here.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. You know, I mean, you can't live in America without thinking about that every once in a while. Mm-hmm. But I think any idyllic landscape, you know, the natural world is beautiful, but it's also ruthless and deadly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, often when I'm at home in winter and it's 5 below outside and, you know, I've got a warm fire going, but, you know, death is 10 feet away. You know, and
indeed.
When that thought passes through your head, it's you get a chill, and not just the one from it being -5.
I feel like there are a lot of ghosts here.
Sure.
Because I'm not used to the cemeteries mm-hmm. like they have here. I'm from California, and they don't have cemeteries out, you know, in the landscape of residential areas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they just have specific cemeteries. You know, one in one town, and then you can drive hundreds of miles, and there aren't any others.
Yeah, you're not going to pass one walking to work.
We have hundreds of them. It's quite haunting to me.
Yeah, well, the dead are among the living. I quite like that. I kind of like being reminded of that. It gives a greater sense, at least to me, of the sort of sweep of life and the presence of death in our lives. And I'm kind of interested in that as a writer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can understand that. Your book also has a lot to do with repressed memory.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like that we have a collective repressed memory in this country?
Yeah, I think
we keep stepping into the same kind of mistakes.
We have a selective memory, you know. I think Americans, you know, there was this thing Bush always used to say about he knew in his heart, or he knew in his gut, you know, or he looked into Vladimir Putin's eyes and he knew he was an honest man.
Yeah, he could see into his soul.
Which was, of course, asinine, and everyone, including Putin, knew that. But there's this sense that you can do that in America, that you go with your gut and your instincts are correct. But I think we react emotionally to things that it would probably be better off that we reacted rationally. And I think when this causes us to run into troubles, when it causes us to do something we know is wrong, we have a way of allowing ourselves to forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
We have very convenient selective memory. And I wanted to sort of reflect this in one person who, he doesn't have amnesia. This is Eric Lesch, the narrator of this book.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have amnesia. He remembers everything, but he's choosing not, he wants to tell what he did and what happened to him, but he doesn't know how to do it.
And he doesn't know who to tell.
No, exactly. It's almost like, He's almost narrating this book to himself. It's an apology and an explanation for what has happened. But he leaves out important details. And the only way that they make it into the story is when other people mention them to him. And then he will allow it into the narrative, you know. But he won't volunteer information, at least not for the first 100 pages or so of the book.
Mm-hmm. I hadn't thought of that as a kind of an American way of dealing with things.
Yeah, well,
that amnesia.
Yeah,
selective amnesia.
Yeah, and that's it's sort of a metaphor for the for how I think how some people regarded the Bush years.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Now, you wrote a satirical novel called Happy Land.
Yeah.
That was rejected by Norton, and then it was picked up by Harper's.
Well, it was accepted by Norton, and it went. It was about to go to press. I went through many drafts with Norton, and then I handed in the final draft, and someone must have panicked because they took it out of the catalog and they canceled it.
To tell us why. What was it about?
It was sort of a parody of what had been going on in Aurora, that is the former doll company mogul Pleasant Roland had bought up a bunch of property there and was renovating it and was sort of turning it into more of an upscale town, which a lot of people in Aurora strenuously objected to. And there was several years of hullabaloo, which seemed like great fodder for a novel. So I made a version of this story in which I made up my own doll mogul, who, as far as I know, was nothing like Pleasant Roland, except that if you knew the story, you realize that's what I was referring to. Mm-hmm. And to her great credit, and I never met or don't even really know anything about Mrs. Roland, but she didn't threaten to sue or anything. And later, after it was all over, the New York Times book review asked her about it, and her representative said, "No, we're not even going to read it. He says it's fiction. So what's the problem?"
Isn't that remarkable?
And of course, it was fiction, uh-huh. And I think it was just, you know, my publisher was afraid that of people with money trying to get more out of them, and yeah. At least that's the only explanation I can come up with. It's
even,
all speculation.
Even to this day, it's still a mystery about why they dropped it.
No, I've never talked to them again about it.
Wow,
so I have a different publisher
amazing.
Now. But Harper's,
for the first time in 50 years.
Yep, Harper's.
Serialized a novel.
Harper's picked it up, and at first they said, "No, we can't do it, it's too long." And my agent at the time quickly said, "Oh, no, no, John has a plan for cutting it." And then she called me and said, "Have a plan for cutting it by Monday." And it was actually pretty easy to do, because it's a very episodic novel. So I removed a few plot lines, and the editor-in-chief there, Roger Hodge, helped me cut it down a little more and smooth it out. And it was incredibly fun to be on the cover of Harper's every month for 4 months.
Yeah. Oh, no, that was remarkable. It was a big thing in this town, too.
Yeah, well, Aurorans I talked to told me that they had a really good time reading it. So
good.
You know, I didn't...
Triumph.
I didn't really know a lot about the real people in Aurora, but there were plenty of local in-jokes for those who wanted to find them.
Now, in addition to being a writer, you are also a musician and composer. Mm-hmm. Are those two separate preoccupations for you, or you know, do you slide into a novel and then turn it into a musical situation?
No, they're mostly separate. I mean, I think music just uses a different part of your brain from writing, and it's nice to have another interest that comes from a different place creatively. I mean, I'm kind of compulsive about making stuff, writing things and recording music, and I like to take pictures, but I'm not one of those people who can get up and start writing at 9 and sit at my desk pretty much all day.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I can I go in maybe hour and a half long bursts, but music really recharges. It shuts off that part of the brain and another part takes over. At least that's how it feels to me. I don't know if it's scientifically accurate.
Mm. Well, what kind of stuff do you compose? Electronic music is what I've heard that.
Well, that's one thing I've done in the past. Yeah, but I guess you could call it indie rock. You know. Just rock and roll songs with electronic elements to them.
And do you write lyrics?
Yeah.
And what kinds of subjects are you writing about as a musician?
Oh, man. Anything that occurs to me. I like to write songs about stuff that no one in their right mind would write a song about.
So you're trying to imitate the characters in your book.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe they're more connected than I think they are.
Uh-huh.
For the story collection, Pieces for the Left Hand, I actually recorded a companion CD, and there's a download link on the back of the paperback, where you can download the American paperback, the one that just came out. You can download the album. The songs are not related to the stories, but there are 100 stories and 100 songs. And the songs were like 30 seconds long.
I remember when that book came out, yeah. So are you somebody who's constantly having to do something? Do you think you have ADD?
I wouldn't call it ADD. I mean, but I definitely always have to be doing something. I think I'm seeing this in my kids, too, that, you know, we're all at my house very distracted, you know, and prone to, like, getting addicted to the Internet.
Because really?
Once we're on something, we can concentrate with great intensity, but when we're not on something, it's a lot of frenetic casting about for an activity. But I will say I'm never bored. There's always something to do.
Mm-hmm. Are you an avid reader too? Do you get ideas from reading or just from taking walks or
both? Actually, I mean, this time of year I like to take walks, but Yeah, I mean, I read tons of, I love crime fiction, you know, because it's all plot. I like to get sucked into that. But I read lots of nonfiction, you know, I'll read like a 500-page book of descriptions of old cameras, you know, sort of technical things and old musical instruments and, you know, this obscure bits of obsolete technology. Reading about things like that interests me. I mean, I read literary fiction, of course, but it's... I don't feel like I'm relaxing when I'm doing it. It's like, it's almost like reading trade journals.
Oh, so it's like work.
Yeah. Until sometimes a really good book, of course, will carry me away. But it's hard to shut off the internal editor. It's hard to shut off the part of me that's going, oh, I would have done it this way.
Really?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So oh, I wonder how many novelists do that. I'd never heard anybody say that.
Really?
No. Uh-uh. That she would have done something differently.
Well, you know, I think you're always checking out the work other people are doing and seeing, you know, and measuring it against yourself. Of course, you have, you know, the calculus is completely fraudulent. No one, you know, no, you don't have one does not have the ability to know how good they are compared to other people or how bad they are.
Mm-hmm.
But it's sort of a tick.
Well, we're almost out of time. What are you working on now? And any new books?
Yeah, I've got about a third of a first draft of a novel right now, tentatively called The Document, about a documentary filmmaker who spends a year filming the lives of an upstate New York farm family.
Ah, uh-huh. It's going to be another quirky book, I can tell.
I think it is. I'm afraid.
Now, real quickly, you teach writing at Cornell. What do you do to inspire your students? Do you have some rules of thumb or?
You know, the thing I like about teaching creative writing is that you can't really work off of a syllabus.
Mm.
You might have a plan, but it always goes off the rails because the material for the class comes from the students and it always surprises me. You know, they always come up with stuff that I couldn't have expected, particularly undergraduates who I think are less aware that they want to be writers. They're just doing something for the hell of it. And as a result, they come up with unusual things.
Mm.
Not, you know, they're not always good, but they're always interesting to talk about. So, and I like to give them exercises, limiting exercises.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's this French group of writers called Ulipo that are famous for doing things like playing tricks with the structure of literature. For instance, the novelist Georges Perec once wrote an entire novel without the letter E in it.
Mm.
Called the English translation is called Avoid. And so I give that as an assignment, that they have to write about a particular subject without using the letter E. Or I'll have them write sentences in a certain rhythm, or I'll have them mess around with how time is structured in a story, or how a place is structured or presented in a story.
Huh, interesting.
Sort of, you know, breaking open the rudiments of fiction to discover new ways of seeing them.
Uh-huh. Well, J. Robert Lennon, we have run out of time. I thank you so much for joining us, and I do recommend go out and get his book, Castle. It's quite interesting.
Thanks, Tish. It was a pleasure.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.